Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Thomas Gehring, or Tom. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. You were the runner-up in The Apprentice this year, in the UK Apprentice.
Yeah, that's correct.
Does it feel bad being the runner-up? Would you have, you know, second place is not bad.
Yeah.
A bit at the start of the process, if you'd said, look, you can have second place
exactly.
Or not, you'd have taken it, but...
Yeah. Disappointing to go so far and obviously fall the final hurdle, to use a cliche, but... I think sometimes second place end up doing better, so we'll wait and see what the future holds.
Have you heard much about how Ricky's going with the investment?
I know he's very busy. I've spoken to him a couple of times. He's actually having to relocate because he was living in Southampton with his wife, and now he's having to relocate to Essex. So he's very much kind of under the thumb now.
Under the thumb of Sir Alan or under the thumb of his wife?
Probably a bit of both. Yeah.
Okay, I want to just talk a wee bit about your experiences on The Apprentice.
Yeah.
Because you're the first wine guy that was on The Apprentice.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And also a wee bit about the business model that you offered to Sir Alan.
Yeah.
And so I suppose, first of all, you know, how did it go in the house? First of all,
in general, it was a really unusual experience and a unique experience. I think at the start, you're kind of more getting used to actually being on a TV program and getting filmed for 16 hours a day, rather than the actual business side of it. And because there's so many of you, you know, 16 of you, you know, everyone's trying to hog the limelight in the early part. So the first two or three weeks were very much kind of going along with it and trying to get to grips with it. But then when the numbers came down, it got a little bit more serious, and there was a lot of pressure to deal with, and you know, there's so many different aspects that go into it that you have to kind of work around. So it was great to get to the final. That's where everyone wants to be, and I got to pitch my idea, which is, you know, what I really wanted. You know, anyone going into that process to get the investment, you want to be able to at least say, this is my business plan. And I got to do that. I, you know, it wasn't for Lord Sugar this time, but you know, I think overall it was a very good experience.
From watching on TV, how long did you get between episodes of filming and things? You know, was it, right, you finished that task, and now tomorrow we're in doing one, or did you get a day off?
No, that's exactly how it works. It was actually a lot more full-on than I was expecting. The whole series was filmed over 6.5 weeks. We'd taken away, live in a house, it was in Queensway. Fantastic house. You get put in a room with four strangers you've only just met, and you get everything taken away from you. No phone, no contact with the outside world, no TV, not allowed to read newspapers. You just film day after day. I mean, on average, you know, a task would be 2 days. So, you know, it'd be a Monday task would be second day would be the task. The third day would then be a boardroom day. And then after someone went home, the next day you'd straight into another task. And we had one day off every 7 days. So it was quite full on. And filming from really early in the morning till late at night. So
a task would typically take 3 days.
Yeah, so actually on task physically doing stuff would be on average 2 days. But the boardroom day would normally take a whole day to do.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that? Is there a lot of cuts and editing and all that sort of stuff, or
do you know what the weirdest thing is? Actually, the boardroom is the one place where there's no stopping and starting at all. It's completely run through from start to finish.
Yeah.
The reason it takes so long is because in the morning before you go to the boardroom, you do a lot of interviews, which they like to cut in during the show, and then you go to the studios where it's shot, and they hold you for about 3 hours to kind of really build up the tension, really build up your nerves. You're all held separately and you can't talk to each other from like different teams.
You're isolated for 3 hours?
Not on your own, but like in your own teams. So you don't see the other people and you're not allowed to talk about what's happened. And then you go into the boardroom. So, you know, that takes up a lot of the day. So you're not starting a boardroom till about 3 p.m. You're held in the meeting room outside for about half an hour, which was an absolutely horrible experience. Then you go in and you just run straight through, and if you luckily win, you're out within kind of 45 minutes and you're back to the house. But if you've lost, you go out, you go to the cafe, you come back, and you know, you've
got that cafe real, because it does look like a woeful cafe.
It actually is real. I think they've just built their reputation from just being on The Apprentice.
Really?
I think they've deliberately not renovated since first featuring.
And you said it was in a studio. What, the boardroom, is it a studio, not a proper office?
Yeah, it's in a studio.
Oh, okay, so it's quite staged almost.
I mean, it is a stage, but you know, when you're in there, you kind of don't really realize that, you know, the way that they produce it is just to kind of really keep you unnerved the whole time, really build up the anxiety, make sure you don't know what's going on at all. And you know, when you are in that boardroom, you know, you've got very much tunnel vision. You know, when Lord Sugar's talking to you, you know, you don't, you completely forget about the cameras that are in the room filming you.
Yeah.
You know, that is it. And when you're under pressure, you know, it does feel very natural. So although it is, you know, in a kind of a stage, obviously set up, you know, you do feel like you're actually in a boardroom with Lord Sugar.
Sure. What was your favourite part of the process?
I mean, I've got favourite tasks. I really enjoyed the first task that I project managed, which was week four, which is a vintage task. I enjoyed that.
Which one was that?
It was like a vintage task. I was the first project manager. We had to go to Brick Lane and sell secondhand furniture. Oh,
yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, that was a really fun task. I suppose the most enjoyable part of it was, you know, getting, having experience in different industries you'd never normally have the opportunity to. So, for example, you know, the second task, you know, 3 days into basically filming, we were pitching to Amazon, for example. You know, opportunities like that are never going to come along. And, you know, to think of an idea, you know, brainstorm in the morning, and the next day, 24 hours later, the product that you've brainstormed in that meeting is suddenly there in front of you.
Yeah.
Is incredible. And, you know, even stupid things like, you know, going to a sauce factory and finding out, you know, actually how they make, you know, condiments and, you know, what goes into it and the machinery used and the base recipes and the way that it's marketed and distributed, you know, all those sort of elements you'd never, ever kind of find out. You know, it's great to actually go in and experience that. So the fact that I did all the tasks, it meant that I got to experience a huge range of different industries, and it was fantastic.
Was it you or Ricky that got a bit tiddly at Dimby's?
It was me and me and Adam. We had a nice day out at Dimby's.
I would have thought you probably didn't need to go there.
Yeah, but I mean that's part of how it works, because it's not structured how you do the task, but you know, there is a certain framework you have to work within. So, you know, for that task, for example, you know, the two project managers of the team were told to go to Denby's, to go to the vineyard. So Ricky from the other team went there and I went there as well. And then when we got there, you know, the option was to either do a wine tasting or to do a tour of the vineyard. So obviously I chose the wine tasting.
Fair enough. Let's talk a wee bit about the business proposal that you got to pitch.
Yeah.
You're up against a HR company, your wine, and then what were the other two?
Nick's idea was a food kind of program, online program, which would help you buy ingredients for the week. The other was Jade's idea, which is kind of a glorified call center, but like the biggest one ever. That was the USP, which is strange. Each to their own.
In the show, we never really got to see the pitch.
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure whether that was because of time restrictions or confidentiality issues or what the reason was. But, you know, we never really got to see the pitch. So is there a reason why you never saw the pitch, and what was your pitch?
I think the reason why you don't really see much about the specifics of each person's business plan was probably more to do with the editing and the amount of time they have to show, you know, and they probably want the juicy bits when, you know, Claude's telling you that you're an idiot and you're arrogant. You know, they want those bits, not the, okay, so year one, you're going to turn over this and have these many people in the office. So the idea was pretty much an extension of, you know, what I currently do now. It's just basically a bolt-on service to what we do here at Cult Wines. And it was taking what we do here on a small scale and taking it larger, getting different types of investors involved and structuring it in a different way to how we currently do it. So exactly the same model, you know, buying wine for investment purposes, you know, dealing with investment grade wine, predominantly from, you know, Bordeaux and Burgundy, but also some Italian, you know, American, Australian and Spanish wines. And, you know, getting investors to put money into over a 5-year period to see a return from their investment, but just done on a kind of bigger scale and as in a collective.
Yeah, because at the moment you sell to individuals.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
As a collective, is it a bit like a unit trust or something like that where they buy X shares in it, or how is that collective structured?
Yeah, I mean, the most similar structure would be a hedge fund structure. And yeah, people would get shares depending on the amount of money they would put into the investment. The reason that I kind of pitched that idea and the reason that's kind of born out of, you know, Cult Wines is, you know, we've had a lot of interest in the last couple of years from different types of investors who can't get involved in how we currently do it because it's an unregulated market. For example, people have self-investment pension plans. They can't include a wine portfolio how we currently do it. So it was a good way to structure wine investment so you could involve people who have SIPs. Also, institutional investors can't get involved. You know, private investment funds, family offices, they can't get involved in the current guise that we offer wine investment. So it was basically, you know, specializing in what I currently do, and I thought that would help in a show like The Apprentice, where, you know, I think in the past people have kind of tried to pitch ideas that they're not involved with, and I think you should stick to things that you know. And with the wine investment fund, it's something that I do believe in would be successful. I do feel there's a market for it, and I do feel the way that I did structure it would be unique to what's currently out there on offer.
Okay, so the idea was to maybe for my pension, for example, I've got a selection of funds that I could potentially invest in. Yeah. So one of them would be Colt Wine Investment Fund.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that'd be correct. Yeah.
Okay. And Sir Eleanor, Ellie Sweetie, Alan Sugar.
Yeah, Shooks.
Shooks. Did you have a nickname for him?
We had ones in private, but they would never be uttered in his presence. You wouldn't take that risk.
Fair enough. The comment that I remember from the show was, he doesn't mind taking a punt and losing his own money. Yeah. He doesn't like taking a punt and losing other people's money.
Yeah.
Which, you know, in the wake of what's going on with Barclays, sounds like quite an honourable thing almost.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, that was the reason he gave. Yeah. That's not always the reason people have.
Yeah.
But, do you think that was a fair reason, or?
I think in part that was probably behind his thinking. I think when you do get, you know, wealthy people like, you know, Lord Alan Sugar, you know, he's probably, you know, like he said, you know, he's probably had loads of people over the years knocking on his door saying, I'll put your name to this, put your name to that. And I think once you do get to that sort of wealth and that size of reputation, you know, and also, you know, I think what's important is his age. You know, he is 69, he is semi-retired. He's already amassed his fortune. He's already done the big things he wanted to do in his life. And, you know, did he want to put a risk of, you know, get involved with a wine investment or a hedge fund for, you know, let's not forget that it was a wine investment, just a hedge fund structure. I think that's what really drove him. He probably thought to himself, you know, I'm my age. I don't necessarily need a load more money if it was successful. And he's taken a safe route, and I respect him for doing that. But I don't think it was necessarily a criticism of the business plan or the idea. I think it was more of a personal preference of himself and the age that he is in the current situation that he has.
Because Nick did say it was, you know, a punt, but could pay up quite well.
Yeah.
That was the impression I got.
Yeah.
And then he decided wasn't really that keen on taking that punt. So, you know, as an entrepreneur, I would have thought, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, you ask Richard Branson, do you want to go for something safe, or do you want to take a 1 in 1,000 chance it fails, but you launch a space agency.
He
goes to the space agency.
Yeah, of course. But I think Lord Alan Sugar had done that all his career as well. You know, he had got involved in things and taken punts and things. And earlier on in the series, when I'd kind of come under fire for taking risks, he'd said to me, you know, face to face, he said, you know, I've taken risks in my career, and, you know, I respect that. You know, I like that. You know,
that was the one where you didn't quite get the painter. And then you went for the one that if you sold one, you'd win.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, roll the dice. But I always felt confident after he said that he would be willing to, you know, push for it. I mean, if you take him back 10 years when he was a little bit younger, maybe 59, he might have still had the, I suppose it might sound a bit condescending, but I might still have had the appetite to go into something like a wine investment hedge fund. But I think maybe just at his age, he's probably happy with what he's got and how he's going forward. And at the end of the day, recruitment company, Ricky's a great guy. He's probably going to make a success of it. If it doesn't work, you know, if it's not the end of the world, it's a recruitment company, it didn't work. If it does okay, it does okay. Yeah, there's not much really to lose apart from that, apart from the money that you put into it. But, you know, Lord Sugar gets paid a fee to do The Apprentice, so I can't see him losing out too much.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he gets for paid, but I'm sure it's a sizable chunk.
It might well be a little bit more than the investment back.
But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I always wondered how much of it's own money.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. At the beginning of the show, you put your proposal forward.
Yeah.
You know, as part of your application process for your business plan, you need to put your business plan in.
Yeah.
But I got the impression that just before the final, you could tweak it and amend it or even completely rewrite it if you wanted to. Is that how it works, or?
I think that the producers would be absolutely delighted that that's how it came across. But no, in actual fact, there was very little we could do at that stage.
Why is that? You just didn't have time? No computers?
No computers. It's just, I think it's just the way that they obviously structured the whole program. I think, you know, if you'd have gone in there and I'd gone, actually, no, I'm coming up with a complete idea, it'd have kind of thrown everyone off track a little bit.
Yeah, I've got this new game, Tiddlywinks
FIFA.
Yeah. FIFA Tiddlywinks.
But yeah, you could make little changes to it and you could add on a little kind of appendix if you said, oh, actually, I thought that I might do this a little bit different, or actually the numbers in year five are wrong. You could put that in there, but by that stage it was far too gone to be making any massive changes.
Sure. And of the interviewers, you know, in the second last round, I think it was, who was the worst?
Claude, by an absolute country mile. And you know, it's a weird thing because I've met him since coming out of filming a couple of times, and he's actually a really, really nice guy, really sharp, really knows what he's talking about. And But when I was in that interview room, it was just one of the toughest situations I've ever been in, because you've got someone there who's digging up the, you know, looking for any angle they can on you, and also they've got your application form. And Ricky got really, like, you know, badly criticized for his application form, but they were the application forms we put in before we even had got asked to come back for like an interview to be on the show. So yeah. Obviously in your application form, you're giving yourself plus about 50 to 75% more.
Then
you're suddenly sitting there, you know, 12 months later, you know, six to 12 months later, being, you know, critically evaluated on what you put in your, in that initial form. But obviously you're going to talk a bit of, you know, bollocks in that bit, so...
Yeah. How much do you think of the initial selection is based on less about business acumen, but more about making sure there's enough conflict, because conflict makes good TV? You know, you see some people and you go, really?
Yeah. I don't know. Do you know what? That's one of the questions I've always had. And I really tried to kind of grill a few of the producers, just going, oh, how do you choose it? How do you choose what? Why did you choose this people? But they never really showed their cards. I think even being in the process, I kind of got the feeling that, you know, there were certain people there who were definitely seen as kind of leading lights, and kind of producers were expecting them to go far and do well. And then you saw some people who were getting there a little bit for the character and the sort of things they would say and the one-liners they'd come out with. And a few other people in there were probably, you know, put in for the, you know, conflict side of it. But the only thing I would say to counter that was that, you know, some people probably were chosen purely on thinking that actually they've got a really good track record. They are good business people. They're going to do well in this process. But actually getting into the process, they really didn't, you know, shine at all, and actually struggled to kind of deal with the actual process of recording it, because it is difficult. You know, for example, my perfect example would be someone like Jane, who I think is actually a fantastic businesswoman. She's got a great business. She sells manufactured foods. She's done a lot in her career already. But she was taken away from her home in Ireland. She's got a husband and two kids, living in a room with like five other girls, for example. And, you know, you could see within the first week or so, there was a lot of strain. She was feeling tired, and she wasn't, you know, quite, I think, the same person they were expecting her to be. So I think that does have a bit to play. And maybe some people end up being a lot worse than they were expecting. And on TV, they might come across as not actually having a lot of acumen, for example. But
yeah, because it is quite an artificial environment, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's very, very stressful. You know, you've got to make decisions very quickly. You've got the cameras on you. Every single mistake or anything you do say is getting picked up on and emphasized. So, you know, you really are under a lot of scrutiny. So it's difficult to kind of, you know, play the game and kind of work out how to get far.
Have you watched the series since it finished?
I haven't watched it since it finished, no. They've sent me all the DVDs to watch, so maybe in a year's time I might break them open.
Oh, okay, I'd be interested to see what you would have thought about that. Have you spoken to anybody who's seen it and said, oh, I can't believe they portrayed me like this? Because when you're recording someone,
yeah.
You know, you can do a real stitch-up job, not that we're going to today.
Yeah, but... I mean, there were certain people that were kind of billed in certain ways. I think, like, Stephen, for example, really came across... Didn't come across... It's difficult, because my opinion is that whatever you say, you've said it, and you can't say, oh, I didn't say it. But it can be edited to emphasize a certain thing, yeah, or maybe to accentuate a bad decision or to make people look like they've fallen out more than they had. But I think in general, you've got to stick by what you've said. And, you know, I said some cringing things. I've made some mistakes. But, you know, that's just the way it goes. And, you know, if you say it, you know, you've said it. But I don't think anyone got too hard a time. I think, you know, everyone came across pretty much as I kind of had the opinion of them as well.
And just to finish up with, you finished The Apprentice, didn't quite win, but when I was trying to arrange to do this interview, I had to talk to your press people and all sorts of stuff. So you've obviously had a lot of good publicity from it.
Yeah.
How much value do you think the process of being on The Apprentice has helped Colt Wines?
Well, I think if you don't win The Apprentice, you know, you've got to make sure you use the exposure, use it as a launch pad to, you know, either build your business into something better or, you know, maybe take some of the opportunities that arise from it. And, you know, I've tangibly seen a result of being on The Apprentice and people thinking that, you know, I have done well or I did represent myself well. People get in touch from the, you know, within the wine industry, people in financial services industry looking to work together, looking at different avenues. So it's difficult for me to say right now what's the tangible result been on Colt Wines, but I think maybe in 6 to 12 months I'll be able to say, well, actually, because of The Apprentice, I was able to do this, this, and this. The exposure allowed me to do this and that. And at the moment, I'm very confident that, you know, there's going to be some great opportunities available to Colt Wines to develop more.
Okay. And the last thing, I was just doing a wee bit of snooping around in the background. I noticed that you've enrolled to do your WSET.
Yeah, I've done a level two.
You've done level two intermediate. And are you going to do level three? Or
diploma? Yeah, I'm planning to do level three. I'm just trying to find the time to fit it in because it's a little bit of a longer course. But
that's but strange to be doing that after you've sort of built up a multi-million pound business.
Yeah.
You know, normally people do that on their way into the industry as opposed to, you know, if you haven't done it then and you've already got a viable business, you wouldn't normally do it afterwards. It was just the order seemed a bit strange. What was the reason for deciding to do it almost so late in the game, really?
I mean, I wasn't really ever going to get the professional, I suppose, qualifications that, you know, WSET brings or the accreditation it brings because I felt that I had a good knowledge of the wine market. I knew what I was talking about. I've grown up with it since I was 11 years old, so I've kind of got a good base knowledge from that. But, you know, being on The Apprentice, one of the things that was brought up was that, you know, that's great that, you know, you've got an experience in it. But at the end of the day, people like the fact that you've got a qualification. People like the fact that you've done accreditation. So that really spurred me on to do it. So I thought, well, at the end of the day, I know that I'm not going to find it too difficult. And actually, the idea of maybe working my way up to diploma level is something that would be quite a fun and enjoyable thing to do over the next few years. So I looked into it a little bit more and I thought, well, you know, I might as well get started now. Did the first course, which was pretty easy. And then looked to do, you know, level three and build up from there. And actually, having done the course, I'd probably have preferred to have done it, you know, earlier because, you know, it does, you know, start to show you a little bit more about wine as a kind of global product rather than just specific areas that I work in.
Yeah, because you're quite niche about what you're into. You're in Burgundy, Bordeaux, Barolo, I presume, and a bit of that. So whereas there's, you know, Croatia makes some nice wines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're not going to be doing them in a fine wine investment. Or maybe you are, you know.
Yeah, some Odessa. Odessa Black or something like that.
Okay, then. All right, then I think we'll wrap it up there, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Cheers, bud.